Josh and I both know. You both appear before us frequently. Each side has 15 minutes to argue. As appellant's counsel, Ms. Fitzgerald, would you like to reserve a portion of that 15 minutes?
3 minutes, if I could, Your Honor.
That'd be great. You have it, and you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, this is Elizabeth Fitzgerald on behalf of the Commonwealth, the appellant today. Unless the Court has a preference, I'd like to begin with the Fourth Amendment waiver issue and then move to the Fourth Amendment early alleged violation in this case.
That's fine.
Thank you. So at the time of the defendant's arrest in this case, he was subject to a valid Fourth Amendment waiver from another case that was still pending before the circuit court. The plea agreement containing that waiver, which is at appendix page 105 through 106, it provides that that waiver will be in effect for a year or significantly until this matter is finally disposed of by the court, whichever is later. And this language was construed by the circuit court with reference to the phrase matter, saying that the matter was the first offender disposition. However, that construction is at odds with the remainder of the document, and under contract law principles, that phrase should be construed to mean that the waiver was in effect until the entire matter, in other words, the case, was finally disposed of by the circuit court. Final disposition of a case is when we have a final sentence, an appealable order, which this court has recognized multiple times. The parties stipulated below that the case was still pending at the time of the defendant's arrest. There was no final disposition, and therefore the waiver was still in effect.
Ms. Fitzgerald, this is Judge Chaffin. You contend the waiver was still in effect. If the waiver was still in effect, then did he remain on probation, and was he still subject to all those terms and conditions?
No, Your Honor. I believe that the defendant had violated the terms of his first offender status and had been convicted by the circuit court, although he had not been sentenced. The terms of the plea agreement provide that the term of probation is 1 year in any event, and I believe it was past that 1 year time. The First Amendment waiver, on the other hand, specifically runs for a different term. It's contemplated in the agreement that the Fourth Amendment waiver could exceed the term of probation by the language, you know, for 1 year, which is the same term as everything else, or until this matter is finally disposed of, whichever is later. So while the term of probation was completed after a year, and while, I guess it was also terminated by the defendant's violation of the terms there, the Fourth Amendment waiver was a separate provision with a separate time. And in that sense, I don't know if the court is thinking about the White case, where the term of probation was not extended when the court continued a matter. In other words, the matter being the whole case was continued, and that continuance order didn't affect the terms of probation. That construction is consistent with the Commonwealth's position here, where the plea agreement itself governs the term, and the court's order extending the matter would apply to the whole case, not to the individual terms.
Okay, thank you. I don't want you to spend too much time on the waiver, so thank you.
Sure. And again, briefly looking at the plea agreement, we have that the waiver is given as consideration for the agreement, not just the term of that probation, which is consistent with it lasting longer than that probation term. We have on the first page a sentence being referred to as a disposition, which is consistent with the final disposition being the final sentence. And as this court looks at this plea agreement and construes it under a de novo standard of review, the court should find, and the Commonwealth urges that the court find, that this waiver was in effect at the time of the defendant's stop in this case, and he was therefore foreclosed from raising his suppression challenge in this case. Moving on to the actual stop itself, unless I can address questions for the court there.
Any further questions in that portion for on the waiver portion for Ms. Fitzgerald?
No question.
No.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's difficult with the on the phone to judge facial.
We appreciate your taking a moment to wait so that if we do have questions, we can ask them. Thank you.
Sure. To move on to the Fourth Amendment issue that was raised below, and again, starting sequentially, I know counsel and I have raised arguments as to different portions, but I think sequentially it is the best way to address it. From the very beginning, the trial court found that the encounter with the defendant was a voluntary encounter. And I will apologize to the court. I quoted a phrase that the defendant jumped out of the vehicle. That is on appendix page 19. That's actually a reference to the passenger who jumped out of the vehicle. But the defendant, trial court found, also voluntarily exited the vehicle, approached the police officer, and then did engage in a consensual conversation, which revealed his name and that he did not have a license, which ultimately resulted in the police officer finding the warrant in this case. The trial court's conclusion that that was a voluntary encounter was correct, and it's not one that the defendant has challenged expressly on appeal. And for that reason, the Commonwealth urges that the court affirm the trial court on that basis there. In any event, if there was a problem with that first seizure, again, as defense counsel has noted, the recent United States Supreme Court case in Utah versus Sharif would dictates that we should, when the officer has the arrest warrant, has a valid arrest warrant that's untainted by any prior illegality, if there was one in this case, it serves to attenuate a subsequent search incident to arrest from anything that happened before it. So even if that initial encounter with the officer was problematic, it wouldn't affect the search of the defendant's person. So moving forward from there.
Cheryl, just one question. Can you clarify for me if the record tells us that the passenger, of course, the passenger was not arrested, right?
To my knowledge, that's correct.
And so the passenger then removed the vehicle later, drove it off? It was not impounded and towed, right?
I don't believe the record establishes that. Mr. Farshadi may have a better factual understanding, but it is my understanding that the vehicle was parallel parked at the side of the road. Of the two vehicles that were there, there was a sedan that was in the road and an SUV that wasn't. So whether the passenger was able to drive the vehicle away or whether it was just left in that place, I don't believe the record is clear as
okay.
to what happened to that vehicle.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Sure. So moving forward sequentially, we have the search incident to arrest in which Officer Ertman uncovered a prescription pill bottle that was not labeled for the prescription for the defendant, some crumpled currency, and a set of car keys. The Commonwealth's position is that the search of the defendant's pocket that uncovered these car keys in particular, happened before any interior search of the vehicle. And it is the Commonwealth's position that the trial court's conclusion to the contrary was incorrect in this case. It is a heavy burden, and we're cognizant of the appellate standard of review. However, in this case, the trial court's factual conclusion that those two searches occurred simultaneously is not supported by the record. The citations, I guess the clearest point where we have this is that the officers testified unequivocally that they needed the car keys to get into the locked glove box. And that's on appendix page 36. And that reference to the locked glove box.
Cheryl, can I interrupt you on that? He certainly says he needs the keys to get into the glove compartment, but there is testimony that the car was unlocked, not from the officer, I don't think, but there was evidence that the car was unlocked. Even if he did utilize the keys before he started searching the car, there's no testimony that indicates the officer at that point had seen the pill bottle that was removed from the in the search incident. officer, when he saw those keys on the bumper of the car, saw a pill bottle, or even that the pill bottle had been pulled out of the clothes at that point by the other officer?
Your Honor, I believe there is the suggestion that the car may have been unlocked was a question from the Commonwealth's attorney, and that's also on appendix page 36. The officer responded, the question was, the car was open, though, you didn't need keys, and the answer was, I don't recall, but then the officer clarifies, I had to use the keys to get into the glove box. There was no testimony from either the officers on that point, and I don't believe that was clarified in cross-examination either. But to answer the court's question as to whether the officer who searched the car was aware of those pills, if you look at appendix page 35, the page right before, Officer Weeks is talking about what the other officer had been doing before the search. Officer Ertman placed him into handcuffs and pulled a bottle of pills out of his pocket that did not belong to him. So at that time, you know, everybody was detained, and we searched the rest of the vehicle at that point. I think the testimony of the officer showed that he was aware of the pill bottles, and that was why the search of the car was happening. And again, we're not... The officer's rather motivation for searching the car is not binding on the court, but it's instructive as to what they believe that they were doing. If you look at appendix page 38, this is the cross-examination of Officer Weeks, where he says that the search was based on the fact of the narcotics that were found in his pocket and that were in a high-crime area. So it appears from the officer's testimony that he was, in fact, aware of what was found, and that was the reason that the car was searched. He's questioned as to whether he knew they were narcotics. He's clear that they are prescription pills that he believed to be narcotics. He is, again, familiar with the nature and character of that area, and I believe that he did know what had been removed incident to arrest before, or I believe the record bears out that he did know what was removed from the defendant's pocket before he began the search of the interior. And at that point, we have the pill bottles and the currency, as well as the car keys, which, if they were not necessary to get into the exterior of the car, they were certainly necessary to get into the glove box, which is where the contraband that the defendant is seeking to suppress was found. So in light of the actual contraband, which was found prior to the search, and if we combine that with the time of the evening, the character of the area, the officer's knowledge of what was going on there, the fact that there were two cars stopped side by side running at midnight in a non-commercial area, plus the presence of contraband in the defendant's pocket. I think under DePriest, the officers there did have probable cause to believe that there would be evidence of that crime, either of the possession or of narcotics distribution inside the vehicle.
Ms. Fitzgerald, thank you for answering my question. I just wanted to interrupt to let you know that you're now into your rebuttal time, so you can either reserve or proceed as you wish.
I would like to reserve. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Farishai?
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the court, this is Afshin Farishai. I represent the appellant, Mr. Garrick. And also, I just want to point out we did file a cross appeal, so I guess for the appellant in that one. I'm sorry, I'm representing the appellee, Mr. Garrick, and the appellant on the cross appeal.
Right.
I'll ask
you on the cross appeal. I was looking at, I believe it's your second assignment of error. Are you still arguing that? I couldn't tell from some of the comments that I think you had made after Utah versus Streif.
Yes, Your Honor. The Streif case definitely has severely undermined our position on that assignment of error, and I guess I really don't want to spend time on that because
sure.
I do think that shows the search of Mr. Garrick is probably going to be found to be legal because of the Streif case, which of course came out after the hearing, but I'm not sure
right.
That's really relevant to. So
okay.
Anyway, I will certainly concede that.
Thank
but,
you.
I do want to address the consequences of it, but if I can just address the Fourth Amendment issue. The Fourth Amendment waiver issue that Ms. Fitzgerald addressed first.
Sure.
I think it's important to begin with the proposition that waiver has to be construed, or has to be, the language has to be construed strictly, and there's always a presumption against a defendant and waiving any kind of constitutional rights. So I think that's the first step in this case, looking at it from that matter. Then the circuit court in this case said that the defined, quote-unquote, this matter as applying to the first offender status. And based on that, the circuit court held that the Fourth Amendment waiver was no longer in effect at the time. Now, I just want to point out that there are actually other reasons, which I know the circuit court did not address, but we addressed in our written motion and also in the lower court as to why that Fourth Amendment waiver did not apply. First of all, in addition to what the circuit court cited, there was stipulated testimony that the car did not belong to Mr. Garrick. It was actually belonged to his girlfriend. And the reason that that is significant is because you look at the language of the waiver, and it talks about the defendant's quote-unquote property, which I would submit to you, it's a narrower narrower object than what we're used to in Fourth Amendment, because, you know, usually if I'm in a car and I have access to it and I'm driving the car, so that, you know, that's the Fourth Amendment.
But he has authority or permission from the owner of the car, which was his girlfriend, to drive.
That is correct, but that is, Your Honor, that is absolutely correct. But remember, the waiver has to be construed strictly, and the waiver talks about defendant's property. It doesn't say property of which he has permission to use. It just says property. So it's important to note that waiver does not apply to the car because that's not his property.
Did you argue that below?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Oh, yes. We argued that below, and we put it in our written motion. Yes, sir. We argued that below.
I'll just make sure.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And I will just point out that this is we're right now on the issue which the Commonwealth is appealing. They're the appellant. We're the appellee on this
right.
waiver issue.
Absolutely.
And then the other thing I just want to point out on the waiver issue is that we introduced this. We argued that the case had been disposed of, which is somewhat of a different argument than what the circuit court ruled on. And we argued that the Fourth Amendment waiver was no longer in effect because Mr. Garrick had been found guilty. So because no one was bound by the agreement any longer, that Commonwealth obviously wasn't bound by it anymore, and only Mr. Garrick should not be bound by it anymore. And that's the argument we made both in our written motion and also in our argument before the court.
But that still doesn't deal with the language. I hear your point on the property, but that doesn't deal with the language finally disposed of by the court, which usually means a final order. Not the 21 days after that order, but an actual final order that's entered, a sentencing order.
Yeah, you're correct that is what that typically means, but in this case, the court ruled that it was finally disposed of because that language referred to the waiver provision. But our position is, going beyond that it was no longer in effect. I mean, just because the contract has some language in it and it says this contract is good up until this point, that's fine, but if there has been an intervening incident that has said the contract is no longer, people are no longer bound by it, then it's no longer bound by it. And what happened in this case is that the Commonwealth alleged, proved, I guess, that Mr. Garrick was in violation of the provisions of the contract, and he was found guilty of it. And then, you know, it was just pending sentencing. So I would submit to you at that point, that plea agreement was no longer in effect. I mean, obviously, if it was in effect still, Mr. Garrick would be still under the first offender statute, and he wasn't at that point. He had been found guilty, and there was pending sentencing. So, you know, we can't pick and choose as to what's in effect and what's not. That contract was no longer valid because they said, hey, he violated, now he's going to be found guilty, and we're just going to sentence him. And it was just pending sentencing. So I would submit to you that no one was bound by it anymore, and it was done. It's a done deal, and so the waiver just did not apply at that point. If you have any other questions on that issue, I'd like to address the...
What is there? I mean, I know we hadn't gotten to... Well, I mean, let me just ask this. I mean,
yes, sir.
Courts frequently will reconsider matters when it's still in their bosom, when a motion to reconsider is put forward to the court. Are you saying that wouldn't have affected it either, had the court reconsidered?
Well, Your Honor, I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, we're talking about this is a special condition of the court's order, and it's I guess I would say a narrow provision of the court's order. So, and it's a unique, I would say it's a unique thing. And, you know, this Fourth Amendment waiver issue, I don't know if any other jurisdiction does it, but I know that this court has affirmed it, so it's fine. I don't think the general rules about disposing of cases and the 21-day rule and, you know, whether you can still modify them, I don't think those apply because, again, I'm going to reiterate, the language has to be construed strictly. And you know, under laws of the contract, you know, going even beyond the criminal law arena, you know, we look at laws of contract when we interpreting plea agreements, and, you know, the author of the agreement, the person who's presented the contract, who's drafted the contract, you know, it's going to be construed strictly against that person, too. You know, I'm just throwing that in there because I think that's another reason for the court to strictly construe the language. So you know, if there is a question about how it should be interpreted, it should be interpreted against the Commonwealth, and that's our point in this case. So I would just simply say it was no longer valid at that point.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, moving on to the substantive Fourth Amendment issues in this case. First of all, the court asked a question, Ms. Fitzgerald, regarding what happened with the car. There's no evidence of that, and even if I had any information, I don't think I can just tell you what that was. But I would just point out that, you know, evidence was introduced that the car belonged to someone else. You know, it could be that they contacted that person to come get the car. But anyway, there's no evidence, nothing in the record to tell us what happened with the car after this incident.
Okay.
I'm gonna address the pill bottle issue because the Commonwealth has placed a lot of reliance on this pill bottle issue, and they've kind of characterized our position, which I respectfully disagree with. It seems like their position is, well, our position is, they're saying our position is that if the court finds that pill bottle contained narcotics, then everything else is okay. No, that's not what we're saying. But let's talk about that pill bottle because it just seems like a lot hinges on that from the Commonwealth perspective. You know, the pill bottle was just that, a pill bottle. And this reference to it as being narcotics, as we pointed out in our both in lower court and on our brief, you know, just saying it's narcotics doesn't make it so. Repeating it's narcotics doesn't make it narcotics. There's absolutely no evidence there was narcotics in that pill bottle, and that's what it was. Now, the officer talked about narcotics, and I was asking him cross-examination. You know, he wouldn't budge from referring to it as narcotics, but just because the officer says it's narcotics without any proof doesn't make it narcotics. I mean, you know, there was no... He didn't say anything that this was, it appeared to be marijuana, or it appeared to be cocaine, it appeared to be whatever. That it was just a pill bottle with someone else's name on it.
Counsel,
that by, yes,
Chaitin, may I ask you, all three officers, as you know, did point out that and call it narcotics, but one of the officers, and I don't recall which one, mentioned that it was a pill bottle, a prescription bottle that
went with
pills in it that were prescribed to someone other than your client. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
Thank you.
And I'm not sure actually the officer testified. He did say it was someone else's name on the bottle, but I'm not sure the officer actually testified there were actually physically pills in the bottle. I think the whole testimony, if you look at it, it was just they kept referring to it as pill bottle without stating there were actually pills in them. I'm not sure that makes a difference, but I just want to make that observation. So the Commonwealth takes the so-called narcotics bottle, which we strongly should dispute, and then from that they say, well, this was, the officer said this was a high crime area, And then they mentioned the positioning of the cars, you know, the reputation of the area. And then from that, suddenly we have probable cause to search the car. And I submit to you that that is just a lot of speculation, a lot of reliance on things that are not in evidence. And, of course, and I've already addressed the pill bottle issue. Just because you're in a bad area, it doesn't give the police the right to search you. I mean, you know, and that's at points it seems like that kind of they get at that. And the Circuit Court, by the way, addressed this in the latter opinion. They cited the case, I think it was Texas versus Johnson, if I'm not mistaken, where you know, just to say that you're in a bad area that doesn't give the police the right to search you. And you know, so the Commonwealth is trying to bring a lot of things together to justify the search. Now, I want to now go to the question I think Judge Bill asked me on the Streif case. Again, I've conceded, and you know, the Streif case is something we actually brought up in lower court when it was still pending. Again, brought up in a petition when it was pending. Unfortunately for us, the Streif case was decided, you know, bad timing for us. It was decided in June, while this case is pending in appeal. So, you know, certainly we will concede the Streif case undermines our argument regarding the search of Mr. Garrick, but that's as far as it goes. Let's keep in mind that the evidence that is the subject of the charge is not the evidence that was found on Mr. Garrick. The evidence that was found that is the subject of the charge was found in the glove compartment of this car. So even if the search of Mr. Garrick is legal because of the Streif case, that does not mean that the search of the car in the glove compartment is legal. And that is a very important distinction. And I want to just cite two reasons. First of all, the reason that was cited by the trial court in this case, and the Commonwealth and I have gone back and forth on exactly what the facts show. The Commonwealth disputes the trial court's assertion or finding a fact that the search of the car and the search of Mr. Garrick occurred simultaneously. The Commonwealth maintains that it could not have done so because the officers did not have the key. Well, that point is not clear, but the trial court made the finding. So as the appellant, the facts are going to have to be looked at in light most favorable to us, the defense, the appellee in this case. The trial court has made that finding. And I will certainly say that the parts of the record that may not be clear on that issue, and as Commonwealth has ably pointed out, but that doesn't get them to where they want to be, which is for this court to make a ruling that the trial court had no basis for its ruling. And I submit to you that the record does not support that contention by the Commonwealth. And I submit to you that if there is a question exactly what occurred, and we don't know, and we defer to the trial judge's finding of fact, and that's what the trial judge has ruled, that the search occurred, I'm sorry, the search of the car occurred after the search of Mr. Garrick. And let me make a second point. Even assuming that the Commonwealth's reading of the facts is correct, I would submit to you that what's found on Mr. Garrick does not allow the Commonwealth, the police in this case, to search the car. Because, you know, just because you arrest someone and doesn't give you the right to search the car. In the old days, before Gant versus Arizona, under the Belton case, they could have done that. But you know, the Gant case made it severely limited the court's authority in searching a car. So I submit to you that in this case, under the Gant ruling, there's no question that Mr. Garrick was outside the car. He could not have access to the car. I think he was in handcuffs at this point, so they can't justify based on that. And let me just point out that, you know,
we've had a lot of questions for you, and your time expired, so I'll give you additional minute to wrap up because we have.
Yes, sir. Yes, I apologize. Thank you very much, John. I apologize. I know. So I would just simply say that the search here we're talking about was found in the glove compartment, and I think that the officers were not justified in searching that car. So I'll be happy to answer any questions the court may have for me.
Any further questions for
Mr. Farishai?
I have none, thank you.
No question.
All right. Well, Mr. Farishai, we thank you for your argument.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Ms. Fitzgerald, you have your remaining rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honors. Briefly, I guess, again, to proceed in the same order as we've been looking at before, with the waiver issue, the defendant has correctly pointed out that there are theories of construction that the document is construed against the drafter, or that the waiver provision needs to be construed narrowly. However, we don't need to reach those because the document here is not ambiguous. There is no ambiguity when this term is read in the context of the rest of the terms in the contract. The court should interpret the contract to give each party the benefit of its bargain. It's significant here, again, that this Fourth Amendment waiver was given as consideration for entering into the bargain, in consideration for giving the defendant the opportunity to perform of his end to have this first offender status.
Even if the court agrees with you on that, how do you answer Mr. Farishai's point that property, the word property is used here, referring to his property, and the car is not his? How do you respond to that?
Twofold, Your Honor. First, I think that if we're going to talk about property in the Fourth Amendment sense and being secure in your person or property, if we're saying that it's his property for purposes of the Fourth Amendment so that he can raise a question and get around standing, I don't see how he can turn around and say that it's in the Fourth Amendment context, it's not my property for this other Fourth Amendment issue. I think they go hand in hand. However, to the extent that the trial court below never reached that issue, finding as a threshold matter that the waiver didn't apply. It was argued below, but since the court found that it could not have been that the waiver wasn't valid at that point, the court didn't reach the issue. So it would be an issue that the court could take up again on remand to determine that if this court were to find that the waiver provision was in effect. There is no ruling on that issue, although the Commonwealth asked for one because the trial court simply didn't get that far in the analytical reasoning framework. But I would, again, say that if it's his possession for purposes of standing and the party stipulated to that, I would say that it falls under his property for purposes of the Fourth Amendment waiver, construing the same term in the same context.
Thanks.
Sure. And I guess I have lost track of my time, but I'm assuming that it is running short.
Yes, you have 30 seconds left. I'm sorry.
I will urge the court to affirm, and I will happily answer questions that the court has in my 25 seconds remaining.
Any further questions for Ms. Fitzgerald?
No questions.
All right. Well, Ms. Fitzgerald, we thank you for your argument. Mr. Farishai, we thank you for your argument. And the court will now go into conference, and we will be back with you before long. Hope you have a good day.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Thank you, Mr. Fitzgerald.
Nice to have you both.